Welcome to Spider on the Web number 74, brought to you, as always, under Creative Commons license, no derivatives, non-commercial.
I'm not scared of dying, and I don't really care if it's petrifying and dying. Well, then let the time be near. If it's petrifying and dying, and if dying time is near, just bundle up my coffin, 'cause it's cold way down there. You know it's cold way down there, crazy cold way down there. And when I die, and when I'm gone, there'll be one more child in this world to carry on, to carry on. Now troubles are many and they're deep as a well. I would swear there ain't no heaven, and I pray there ain't no hell. Swear there ain't no heaven, and I pray there ain't no hell. But I'll never know by living, only my dying will tell. Only my dying will tell. Oh, only my dying will tell. And when I die, and when I'm gone, there'll be one more child in this world to carry on, to carry on. Give me my freedom for as long as I breathe. All I ask of living is to have no chains on me. All I ask of living is to have no chains on me. And all I ask of dying is to go naturally. All I want to do is go naturally. Well, here I go. Hey, hey. Here comes the devil. Right behind. Look out, children. Here he comes. Here he comes. Hey, hey, hey. Don't want to go by the devil. Don't want to go by the demon. Don't want to go by Satan. I don't want to die uneasy. Just let me go naturally. And when I die, and when I'm dead and gone, there'll be one more child. Carry on.
My dinkum word. When a song has already had at least three truly superb versions of it recorded, what are the odds that 40 years later, a man could manage to come up with the definitive version by singing it all by himself with only his own harmonica for accompaniment. Only one man I know would even have been crazy enough to try such a loony stunt. And since that man is Watermelon Slim, the greatest blues singer alive, he nailed it, as you just heard. That was And When I Die, written by the late great Laura Nyro, who, by the way, was born Laura Nigro. It appeared on her very first record, More Than a New Discovery, was made into a huge hit first by Peter, Paul, and Mary, then by Blood, Sweat, and Tears, and has been covered by dozens of others, but I don't think anybody has ever done it prouder than Watermelon Slim. That was from his latest CD, No Paid Holidays. A little later on, I'll play you a more typical Slim track in which he is backed by his well-named band, The Workers. But first, I want to apologize and try to make amends to any subscribers who might be cheesed at me for being late with this podcast. And the song I opened with kind of helps explain why. You see, for the past couple of weeks, both Jeannie and I have been serving as the helplessly devoted love slaves of Marissa Alegria Robinson da Silva, our 5-month-old granddaughter. Clearly, the end point of evolution, Marissa has already become an Olympic-level champion at the only two sports presently open to her, grinning and diaper-filling, and both require a lot of attention from her devoted chelas. She and what's-their-names, her parents, Terry and Jerome, that's it, have just left, gone back to New York, where they will spend a month or so packing up all their stuff, and then move back here with the babe. Turns out Marissa is the most effective medicine yet discovered for Jeannie's ongoing battle with biliary cancer. After 2 weeks in Marissa's daily presence, Jeannie and I were quite unsurprised to be told that the potential cancer markers in Jeannie's blood samples have plunged precipitously for the first time in many months, and her blood platelet level has rebounded so high that she can now resume regular chemo without worrying about bleeding out from a paper cut or stroking out from momentary accidental exposure to Fox, quote, news, unquote. Good news all around, and happy prospects for the future, in other words. So it's time to celebrate that by finally producing for you another podcast with some Verschluggener science fiction content for a change. Even better news, it's not science fiction by me, even though it will be read aloud by me. Human Readable was written by Doc Cyberspace himself, the first man to blog his own birth in advance. Whose help do you need if you've become addicted to the UK's longest-running TV soap opera, Coronation Street? That's right, the Cory Doctor. Ever in search of new records to set and new ways to bring us joy, Cory Doctorow is putting together an experimental audio short story collection called With a Little Help. As the name suggests, it will consist of Corey's sometimes gory but never hoary stories read aloud by a bunch of friends of his, among whom I am happy and proud to be numbered. Neil Gaiman is another. For a complete list, rummage around Corey's website, www.craphound.com. And here, with just a little further ado, is my contribution to the shenanigan, Machine Readable. You want to know how dumb I can be sometimes? I actually asked Corey if it would be okay for me to run this in my own podcast. Swear to God. To give it a touch of value added, I'll take an intermission break halfway through and turn you on to one of the most interesting young jazz singers in literary history. That's what I said. But right now, get comfortable, because here comes part one of Human Readable by Cory Doctorow. Originally published in Future Washington, Ernest Lilly, editor, WSFA Press, 2005. 1. Nice networks don't go down. It was unthinkable that the invisible ants that governed all human endeavor should catastrophically fail, but fail they did, catastrophically, on the occasion of Trish's 8th date with Rayner. It took 19 seconds for the cascade of errors to slow every car in the interstate to a halt, to light up the dashboard with a grim Xmas tree of errors, to still the stereo and freeze the tickers of information and context that they had come to think of as the crawling embodiment of the colony that routed all the traffic that made up their universe. "We are going to be so late," Rayner said, and Trish swiveled in her seat to look at him. He was fretting again, his forehead wrinkled and his hands clenched on the steering wheel. When they traded massages, third date, and she'd rubbed at his hands, she'd found them tensed into claws that crackled with knuckle fluid when she bent each finger back and rubbed sandalwood-scented oil into it. He was mighty cute for a neurotic. At least he knew it when he was being nuts. Not that he'd stop being nuts, but he'd cheerfully admit it. "We are not going to be late," she said. "We just need to manually route ourselves out of the dead spot and get back to the grid, and we'll be on our way. We've got plenty of time." "Dead spot?" "Yes," she said. His forehead wrinkles were looking more Klingon by the second. "Dead spot," she forced a chuckle. "You didn't think the whole world was down, did you?" He relaxed his knuckles. "Of course not," he said. "Dead spot. Probably ends up at the turnoff." "Right," she said. "We need a map. I'm Navigatrix, you're pilot. Tell me where your maps are, then get onto the shoulder and drive straight." "Where my maps are? Jesus, what century do you live in? My maps are with the sextant and sundial between my leeches and my obsidian sacrifice knife." She laughed. "Okay, pal, I'll find a Michelin, you drive. Every car has a couple maps. They self-assemble from Happy Meal boxes." She opened the glove compartment and started rooting through it while he pulled onto the shoulder and gunned the tiny two-seater along it. "This is so illegal," he said. "Now," she said, "I'm pretty sure you're allowed on the shoulder when the routing goes down. It's in the written test manual. Learned it while I was helping my little cousin Lily study." "Aha," she said, holding something up. "You have a cousin named Lily? That's uniquely horrible." "Shut up," she said. "Look at this." It was an old-fashioned phone of a certain handsome retro line that made it look like a dolphin fucking a silver dildo, the kind of thing marketed to old people who wanted a device with its affordances constrained to collapse the universe of all possible uses for things that fit into your hand into the much smaller universe of, say, a cell phone. "Yeah, my mom left that behind a couple of years ago. I looked everywhere for it but couldn't find it. She must have been snooping in the glove box. Serves her right. So what? These things can unmesh and talk straight to a tower at a long distance, can't they?" "I don't know, can they?" "Oh, yes, they can, which means that they work in dead spots, so we can call and get directions." "You think you're pretty smart, huh, Dumpling?" She put her finger to her temple and made an adorable frowny thinky face and held it until he looked at her and laughed. They'd discovered their ability to make one another laugh when he'd farted while taking off his kilt, second date, and had reflexively swung the hem back to make it appear that his mighty gust was ruffling the pleats. "What's your mom's number?" she said. He recited it, and she tapped it in. "Hi there, this is Trish, Rainer's friend. We're on the way, but the say the grid's down or something. The car doesn't have any nav system, the Dolby's out, the interstate's a parking lot." "Oh, you too? God, I wonder if it's the whole country. Well, so we need directions from San Luis Obispo to the cemetery, if possible." "Why, yes, it's Venti. Nice to be meeting you," she said. "I've heard a lot about you, too." "Yes, I'm giving directions. He's driving." "Oh, that's so sweet of you." "Yes, he does look like he's going to scrunch his forehead into his upper lip. I think it's cute, too." "Right. Got it. Left, then right, then left, then a slight left, then up the hill. Got it. Whoops, that's the Duracell. Better go. Soon." "Yes. Whoops." "So?" he said. "So your mom sounds nice." "You got the directions?" "She gave me directions. So you know where we're going." "I don't have a single solitary clue." "Your mother gives terrible directions, darling. Pull off at the next exit and we'll buy a map." "We are going to be so late." "But now they know we're late. We have an excuse. You, stop fretting." Once they were on the secondary roads, the creepiness of the highway full of stopped cars and crane-necked drivers gave way to a wind-washed, soughing silence of waves and beach and palms. Trish rolled down the window and let the breeze kiss the sweat off her lip, watching the surfers wiping out in the curl as the car sped toward the boneyard. "Are you sure this is the kind of thing you're supposed to bring a date to?" "Yes," he said. "Don't fret. That's my job." "And you don't think it's even a little weird to take a girl to a cemetery on a date?" We're not burying anyone," he said. "It's just an unveiling." "I still don't get that," she said. "I keep picturing your mom cutting a ribbon with a giant pair of gold scissors." "Right, let's take it from the top," he said. "And you better not be getting me to talk to stop my fretting, because appealing to my pedantic nature to distract me is a very cheap trick." "I'm fluttering my eyelashes innocently," she said. He laughed and stole a hand through the vent in her apron trousers and over her thigh. "Achtung," she said. "Eyes on the road, hands on wheel, mind in gutter, this instant." She put her hand over his, and he put down the pedal. His hand felt nice there. Too nice for only 8 dates and 20-some phone calls and about 100 emails. She patted it again. "This is kind of fun," he said, as they zipped past some surfer dudes staring glumly at their longboards displays, their perfect tits buoyant and colored like anodized aluminium with electric-tinted sun paste. "Ahem," Trish said, squeezing his hand tight enough to make his knuckles grind together. "You were about to explain tombstone unveiling to me," she said, "when you got distracted by the athletic Twinkies on the roadside. But I am sweet-natured and good and forgiving, and so I will pretend not to have seen it and thus save us both the embarrassment of tearing out your eyelets of Langerhans, all right?" She fluttered her eyes innocently in a way she happened to know made him melt. "Explaining, yes. Okay, remember, I'm not particularly Jewish. I mean, not that my parents are either. They're just Orthodox. They don't believe in God or anything. They just like biblical law as a way of negotiating life. I renounced that when I dropped out of yeshiva when I was 12, so I am not an authority on this subject." "Let the record show that the witness declared his utter ignorance," she said. "But I don't get this atheist Orthodox thing either." "Well, just think of them as Mennonites or something. They find the old ways to be a useful set of rules for navigating the universe's curves. God is irrelevant to the belief."
"So they don't believe in God, but they pray to him?"
"Yeah," he said. The surfers were all coming in now, jiggling their boards and rebooting them and staring ruefully at the radical cutback off the lip dude gnarly as they plodded up the beach. "The ritual is the important part, thinking good thoughts, having right mind. It's good advice, most of it. It doesn't matter where it comes from or how it got there. What matters is that if you follow the law, you get to where you're going, in good time, with little pain. You don't know why or how, but you do."
"It's like following the ants," she said, watching the stop-and-go traffic in the other direction. "Don't know why they tell us to go where they do, but they do, and it works."
"Well, I guess," he said, using the tone of voice that told her he was avoiding telling her how wrong she was. She smiled. "Anyway, the thing about Jews, ethnic Jews, cultural Jews, forget the religion here, is that we're pretty much on the melodramatic end of the grieving scale. We like to weep and tear at our hair and throw ourselves on top of the coffins, right? So there's like 5,000 years of this, and during that time, a bunch of social scientists, rabbinical scholars, have developed a highly evolved protocol for ensuring that you grieve your dead enough so that you don't feel haunted by guilt for having failed to honor them, but not grieving so much that you become a drag on the tribe. When someone dies, you bury him right away, usually within 24 hours. That means that you spend an entire day running around like your ass was on fire, calling everyone, getting the word out, booking last-minute travel, ordering in from the caterers, picking out a box, fielding consoling phone calls, getting the rabbi on the phone, booking the limo, so much crap you can't even spare a second to fall to pieces. And then you bury him, and while you're at it, your family extrudes a volunteer to go over to your house and take all the cushions off one of the sofas, hang sheets over all the mirrors, and set out enough food to feed the entire state, along with an urn of Starbucks the size of an oil drum. Before the service starts, the rabbi gives you a razor blade, and you slash a hole in your lapel so that you've got the rent in your heart hanging out there in plain sight, and once you get back home, you spend 7 days grieving. You pray 3 times a day with a quorum of 10 men, facing east and singing the Kaddish, this really, really depressing song, prayer, dirge that's specially engineered to worm its way into the melancholy receptors of the Semitic hindbrain and make you feel really, really, really miserable. Other people come over and cook for you all 3 meals. You don't see yourself in the mirrors. You don't sit on cushions. You don't do anything except mourn for a whole week. Then it's over. You take a walk, leaving by one door and coming back in by the other. You put the mourning behind you and start your new life without your dear departed. You've given over your whole life for a whole week, done nothing but mourn, and you're completely sick of it by then, so you're almost glad to be done. Then, 6 months or a year later, usually just before Jewish New Year's, which is in the fall, you have a tombstone erected at the gravesite. The stonecutters tie a white cloth around it, and everyone gathers there, and this is sermon, and that dirge again, and more prayer, and everyone has a good hard cry as the scabs you've accumulated are ripped away and all your pain comes back fresh and scalding, and you feel it all again in one hot second and realize with a guilty start that you have been neglecting the memory of the loved one, which is to say you've gotten on with your life even though his is over, which is to say that you've done perfectly healthy normal stuff, but you feel totally, completely overwhelmed with guilt and love, which are kind of flip sides of the same emotion.
You don't believe that, do you? She held her breath.
Well, kind of. Not that they should be, but hell, they are most of the time, then.
Good thing we're not in love, then, right? she said, in reference to their sixth date, when they'd decided they would hold off on any declarations of love for at least an entire year, since they were most often moved to utter the three words of significance when they were besotted with, e.g., post-orgasmic brain juice or a couple of cocktails. "Yes, counselor." She shook her head. He knew she was an academic, not a practicing lawyer, but he loved to tease her about it ever since she'd revealed, after third date on the phone, that she'd spent about 10 seconds in private practice after she'd worked for her congressman and before she'd joined the faculty at UCLA. "You're out of order," she said. "This whole damn car is out of order," he said. "So that's the ritual. You said you wanted to meet the parents and sisters and aunts and grandmothers and cousins and uncles and nephews and in-laws the next time we all got together. This is it." "Right," she said. "I asked for this." And she had, of course. Hadn't asked for the graveside elements, but she'd been curious to meet his big sprawling enterprise of a family that he was always nattering on about. This seemed as good an occasion as any. "So," she said, "is this a traditional date among your people?" He chuckled. "Yes, this is Yom Shiksa, the ritual bringing of the Gentile woman to the family so that she may become the subject of intense, relentless scrutiny and speculation." She started to laugh, then saw that the tractors were stilled in the fields they were passing, that a train was stopped in its tracks, that the surfers were unable to get their roll-cage dune buggies to take to the road. "You all right, babe?" he said, after a couple minutes of this. "Just wondering about the dead spot," she said. "I wish we knew what had happened." "Nothing too bad, I'm sure," he said. "It's all self-healing. I'm sure we'll be back online soon enough." They rolled into the parking lot for his family's shul's section of the giant graveyard a few minutes after 1 p.m., just over an hour late, along with the majority of the other attendees, all of whom had to navigate manually. "Where are your sisters?" Rainer's mother said, even before he'd kissed her cheek. Rainer screwed his face up in a scowl and dug in his pocket for a yarmulke. "Do I know? Stuck in traffic, Ma. The grid's down everywhere." Trish watched this bemusedly in her cool, loose cotton apron trousers and blouse. She scuffed her toe conspicuously, and Rainer turned to her, and it was as though he'd forgotten she was there. She felt a second's irritation, then a wave of sympathy as she saw the spasm of anxiety cross his face. He was nervous about her meeting his fam, and nervous about who would arrive when, and nervous about where his sisters were with their enormous families and meek husbands trapped somewhere on Southern California's squillion-mile freeway network. "Ma," he said, "this is my friend Trish." "Pleased to meet you, Mrs. Feinstein," Trish said. The old woman was remarkably well-preserved, her soft skin glowing with heat flush, her thick hair caught in a tight bun and covered with a little scarf that reminded Trish of Rainer's yarmulke. She wondered if she should be wearing one, too. Mrs. Feinstein's eyes flicked quickly to her shoes, up her legs and boobs to her face and hair, and then back to her face. She opened her arms and drew Trish into a hug that smelled of good, subtle perfume, though Trish knew so little about scent that she couldn't have said which. "Call me Reba, darling," she said. "It's so good of you to come." And then she was off, hustling to corral a wayward knot of horseplay-aged cousins, stopping to shake hands with the deceased great-uncle's poker buddies in their old man pants, golf shirts, and knit yarmulkes bobby-pinned to their thinning hair. Trish took stock. Looked like every other graveyard she'd been in, which wasn't that many. At 35, she'd been to half a dozen family funerals, a couple of college buddies who OD'd or cracked up their cars, and one favorite poli-sci teacher's service, so she was hardly an expert on boneyards, but something was amiss. "What's with the pebbles on the headstones?" she whispered to Rainer, who was scanning the road for signs of his sisters. "Huh? Oh, you drop those on the monument when you visit the grave as a sign that someone's been there." "Oh," she said, and began to cast about for a pebble she could put on his great-uncle's headstone once it was unveiled. There were none to be found. The ground had been picked completely clean. Looking at the thousands and thousands of ranged marble headstones, each topped with a cairn of stones, and not just stones either, toys and seashells and small sculptures she saw now, and she understood why. "What are you doing?" Rainer asked. He might have been irritated or just nervous. It was hard to tell when he was fretting, and he was clearly going cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs. "Looking for pebbles," she said. He said, "Fuck," very quietly. "I meant to bring some. Damn it, I got 20 relatives buried here, and I'm going to have to go past every single tombstone before we get to leave, and I don't have a single rock." "Can you leave toys or other stuff, like on those stones?" Yeah, he said, I suppose, if I had other stuff. She opened her purse and pulled out the Dolphin Dildo cell phone. You still need this? She said. He smiled and his forehead uncreased. You're a genius, he said. She set it down on the pavement and brought her heel down on it hard, breaking it into dozens of fragments. All the pebbles we'll ever need, she said, picking them up and handing them to Raynor. He put his arm around her shoulders and squeezed. I'm awfully fond of you, Counselor, he said, kissing her earlobe. His breath tickled her ear and made her think of the crazy animal, new relationship energy sex they'd had the night before. She was still limping, and so was he, and she shivered. You too, Stanky Paste, she said. Now introduce me to all of your relatives.
Introduce you? He groaned. You don't think I remember all of their names, do you?
Afterward, they formed a long convoy back to the nearest family member's house. A great-aunt, a second cousin, Raynor was vague, navigating by keeping everyone in sight, snaking along the traffic jam that appeared to have engulfed the entire state, if not the whole coast.
You made that law, yes? We've all heard about you.
This was the sixth time someone had said this to her since they'd arrived, and Raynor had made her a plate of blintzes, smoked salmon, fresh bagels, boiled eggs, and baby green salad with raspberry dressing, then had been spirited away into an endless round of cheek-pinching and intense questioning. She'd been left on her own, and after having a couple of grave conversations with small children about the merits of different toys, she'd been latched upon by one of the relatives and passed from hand to hand.
I was involved in it, but I didn't write the law, she said. Look at you, so modest you're blushing, the relative said.
She reached out to steady a cut-glass vase as it wobbled in the wake of two small boys playing keep-away with a third's yarmulke, and Trish realized that this was probably the hostess. This place is just supercalifragilistic, she said, with an economical gesture at the tasteful Danish furnishings, the paper books in a handsome oak bookcase, the pretty garden out one side window, and the ocean out the back window.
Thank you, the great-aunt said. My Benny loved it here.
She missed it up. Trish finally added two and two, remembered the Benjamin chiseled into the marble headstone and the blank spot on the other half of the tombstone, realized that this wasn't just the hostess, this was the widow, and felt about for a thing to say.
It was a beautiful ceremony, she said. She had a couple napkins tucked in the waistband of her pants, and without thinking she had extracted one and folded an angle into it, reaching for the corner of the great-aunt's eye.
Look up, she said, and blotted the tear before it could draw a line of mascara down the widow's cheek. The old woman smiled a well-preserved smile that reminded Trish of Raynor's mom.
You're a sweet girl, she said. Me, I'm not so good with names, and so I've forgotten yours.
I'm Trish, Trish said bemusedly. Raynor's grammar got Yiddishized when he wasn't paying attention, and she adored the contrast between its shtetl credibility and his witty, smooth, public banter persona. It had attuned her to little phrases like, "Me, I'm not so good." The widow shook her hand.
"I'm Dorothy. It's a pleasure to make your acquaintance. Would you like to come out to the garden with me?"
Once they were seated, young male relatives materialized and set up shade umbrellas and brought out trays of iced juice.
"They're not after the inheritance, you know," the old woman said with a snort. "Their parents are very well off. They don't need for money. They just adore me because I've spoiled them rotten since they were babies, and I'd take them swimming into Disneyland."
"You have a beautiful family," Trish said.
"Do you have a big family, too?"
The old woman put on a pair of enormous sunglasses and sipped at her pink grapefruit juice.
"Not like this one," she said. There were a couple of hundred people in the house, and Raynor had spent the whole car ride back from the cemetery fretting about all the relations who hadn't made it.
"Oh, this one. Well, this is a special case. This family accumulates other families. My Benny had a small family, and when he married me, they just joined us. All the high holidays we ate here or at my parents' place, God rest them. Your family is in D.C.?"
"All over."
"But you're from D.C., no?"
"Not really. I grew up in Chicago and Seattle."
"But you made that law."
"I really didn't, honestly. I was clerking for a Supreme Court judge when the case was heard, and I wrote his dissenting opinion, and when we lost, I quit and went to work for a PAC that was agitating for copyright reform to accommodate free expression. And then when Senator Sandollar got voted in and they started the Intellectual Property Committee and made her chairman, I joined her staff as a policy wonk. So I worked on it, along with a couple of thousand other people, not counting the millions who contributed to the campaign and the people who knocked on doors and so on."
"How old are you, darling?"
35, she said.
At 35, I was having babies. You, listen to you. Listen to what you've accomplished. I'm proud just to listen to you. Rayner is lucky to have you. You two will get married.
Trish squirmed and felt her face grow hot. Neither of them really believed in marriage. Whenever anyone brought the subject up around Rayner, he'd grimace and say, "Are you kidding? It'd make my mother far too happy. She'd keel over from joy."
There was some kind of disturbance down the beach, one that had been growing steadily over the past several minutes, and now the relatives were all turning their attention that way, to a couple of small boys in miniature suits who were ruining the shine on their shoes, running in the sand like lunatics. Something in the way they were running, the distant expressions she couldn't quite make out on their faces. It made her think back to high school, to working as a beach lifeguard on Lake Michigan in the summers, and before she knew what she was doing, she'd kicked off her shoes and was running for the shore, her legs flashing immodestly through the vents in her apron trousers. She was still yards away from the hissing surf when she began to assess the situation. There was the small boy, bobbing in the ocean, where the undertow had spit him up after sucking him under. There was the swimmer, unconscious on the beach, face down. Couldn't tell if his chest was moving, but the small boy was in a suit, not swim trunks like the swimmer, and that meant he was part of Rayner's family, which she had begun on the 8th date, no less, to think of as her own, and so she had him as her primary target before she reached the sea. She didn't bother finicking with the buttons on her top, just grabbed her collar and yanked, leaving her in a bra that revealed less than some bikinis she owned, but did so through a cunning arrangement of lace, mesh, and structural engineering that was probably illegal in Texas. She undid the bows on each hip, holding up her pants, and stepped out of them, leaving behind a very small pair of white panties whose primary design consideration had been to avoid showing lines through thin trousers, with modest coverage of all her nethers coming in a distant second. She plunged into the water without hesitation, moving swiftly but surely, taking care to keep her feet dug in against the undertow as she waded out toward the young boy. She was a strong swimmer, but the water was shockingly cold after the heat of the garden and the buzzing afternoon, and it sucked at her calves and legs like a jacuzzi intake. Her breath roared in her ears as she rode the swells, and then she was soaked by a succession of breakers, and then she had the boy's little hand. She hauled him to her, seeing that he was only 5 or 6, and that his pouting lips were alarmingly blue, and that his skin was as pale as cream. She scooped the water out of his mouth, hooked her arm around his neck, and tilted his head back and began to slosh back toward shore. When she was waist-deep, immodestly revealed in a bra that she was quite certain had gone completely transparent, she pinched his nose and blew into his mouth, not quite getting her mouth out of the way before he vomited up a gush of salt water, blintzes, Diet Coke, and bile. She spat and wished she could duck her head and get a mouthful of ocean to rinse with, but she couldn't without dunking the boy, too, so she hauled him up out of the water and handed him to the relative who was standing with his arms on the shore, his fine leather shoes soaked with cold seawater. She looked for the swimmer and saw that he was still face down in the sand. "You, you, and you," she said, pointing at 3 young cousins whose wide eyes were flicking from her boobs to her crotch. "White underwear, Christ, why white underwear today?" to the boy on the sand, who was mobbed now with relatives whose hubbub had reached deafening proportions. "Go to the house, find an old-fashioned phone, and call emergency services. Tell them where we are and that we have 2 drowning victims, 1 a child, neither breathing. What are you going to do?" The tallest of the 3 managed to make eye contact long enough to say, "Find a cell phone, call emergency, tell them where we are, 2 drownings, not breathing." "Right," she said. "Come back when you're done and tell me that it's done." "You, you," she said, picking out 2 tall uncles who looked like they'd worked out or played sports before they found whatever careers had paid for the nice suits they were wearing. "Carry him here and lay him down on his side." She looked for Rayner and found his ass sticking out of the scrum around the boy. She snagged him by the belt and dragged him back. "Rayner," she shouted. His forehead was scrunched, but he was clear-eyed and grim and looked like he was listening to her, which she found very pleasing. "You need to get everyone back at least 5 steps from that kid and make them quiet down," she said. "Right," he said, and took off his jacket and handed it to her. "Hold it yourself," she snapped. "I've got things to do." "It's to wear," he said. She surprised herself with a grin. "Thanks." The relatives were murmuring or crying or bickering, but Rayner hollered, "Listen up!" he said. "All of you get over there by that rock now, or my girlfriend won't be able to save Jory's life. Go!" And they went, amazingly, crushing back so quickly they looked like receding tide. The tall uncles deposited the swimmer in the sand between them, and she checked his breathing and saw that it was good. "Turn him on his side and tell me if he starts to choke," she said, and turned to the little boy, struggling to remember her rescue breathing. She got the boy breathing and ended up with more puke on her face, on Rayner's jacket, in her hair,
His pulse was thready, but there. She turned to the swimmer and saw that he was a muscular surfer dude in board shorts with a couple of bitchin' tats and a decent body paint job. He was breathing, too, but his heart was erratic as hell. She pressed two fingers to his throat.
"What happened?" she said. "Who saw it happen?"
One of the aunts stepped forward and said,
"My son says they were playing."
She held up her hand.
"Where's your son?"
she said.
"He's back at the house," the aunt said, startling back.
"Send someone for him, then tell me what happened."
The aunt looked like she'd been slapped, but the other relatives were staring at her, and so she had to talk, and then the boy arrived and he told it again, and it was pretty much the same story, but she was able to get more details as she began to examine both the boy and the surfer's body for cuts, bruises, breaks, and punctures. She gave the boy's clothes the same treatment she'd given her own, gently but forcefully tearing them off, using a seashell to start the tears at first, then a pocket knife that someone put in her hand. The story was that the kids had been playing when they'd seen the surfer floating in the breakers, and they'd dared each other to fish him out, and the undertow had sucked them out to sea. One had gotten away, the other had ended out beyond the waves, and meanwhile the surfer had beached himself on his own. "Right," she said. "Blankets and pillows. Elevate their feet and wrap them up good." She stood up and staggered a step or two before Rayner caught her, and the crowd made a noise that was at once approving and scandalized.
"Get me to the sea," she said. "I need to soak my head."
So he walked her into the water, he still in his suit pants and dress shirt and tie, and held on to her while she dunked her head and swirled a mouthful of salt water in her mouth.
"Where are the fucking paramedics?" she said as she sloshed back out with him.
"There," he said, and pointed at the horizon where a Coast Guard clipper was zooming for the shore. "The cell phone was dead, so I fired up a couple of flares. You didn't hear them?"
"No,"
she said. He could have set off a cannon and she wouldn't have noticed it. She got back to the shore just in time to see the surfer convulse. She was on him in a second, kneeling at his side, doing airway breathing circulation checks, finding no pulse, and slamming him onto his back and beginning CPR. Sometime later, she was lifted off him, and two paramedics went to work on him. Someone put a robe over her shoulders and a cup of juice in her hands. She dropped the juice in the sand, and sticky liquid and beach sand covered her legs, which she realized now that she hadn't depilated in a week, and that made her realize she'd spent a pretty crucial amount of time prancing around naked in front of her date's family, and that that was probably not on the timetable until the 15th date at least. She looked up at Rayner, who was still in his shoes, and as she was in her bare feet, loomed over her.
"God," she said. "Rayner."
He kissed her. "I love you, Patricia," he said.
"Ooh," she said with a weak smile. "You're breaking the rules.
Can you let it go this once?" She made her scrunchy, thinky face and then nodded.
"Just don't make a habit of it, you lunk."
It would have been perfect if only the surfer hadn't died. They didn't get home until well after midnight. Parts of L.A. appeared to be on fire as they inched their way along the freeway. It was weird to see L.A. at this speed. They were used to clipping along at 60 or 70, over 80 if the traffic was light, flying over the freeway so fast that the scenery was just a blur. Only the year before, the New Yorker had run a 40-page paean to L.A., a public apology declaring it the most livable city in America now that it had licked its traffic problems. It balanced lots of personal space with thorough urbanization and urbanity. It was why they both lived there. Now, they seem to have traveled back 50 years in time, to the bad old traffic jam and smog days. Looters danced below, torching stores, and the traffic moved so slowly that some people were apparently abandoning their cars to walk home, which made the traffic even worse. The smoke from the fires turned the sunset into a watercolor of reds and mustards and golds, tones that had blown away with the smog when the last gas-sucking Detroit mobile was retired for a plastic nickel-metal hydride jelly bean, and all the lanes were repainted to cut them in half. It was nightmarish. When they got off the ramp at Studio City, they found homeless guys directing traffic with gas tubes they'd torn out of the bus shelters. The tubes glowed in the presence of microwave radio frequency radiation, and as each of the trillions of invisible ants in the system attempted to connect with its neighbors and get the traffic set to rights again, the RF noise made the tubes glow like sodium lamps. They coasted into Trisha's driveway and collapsed in her living room. "You were wonderful, darling," Rayner said, peeling off the tracksuit that one of his cousins had scrounged from the gym bag in her trunk and donated to Trish. Her skin was gritted with sand and streaked with stripes of sunburn. God, Trish said, lolling back on the sofa, just letting him gently brush away the sand and rub lotion into her skin. You spoil me, she said. You're unspoilable, he said. Wonderful girl, you saved their lives, he said. What a fucking day, she said. You think that my lifeguard training made up for my scandalous undergarments in your family's minds? He snorted, and she felt his breath tickle the fine hairs on her tummy. You're kidding. My mom told me that if I didn't marry you, she'd have me killed and then fix you up with someone else from the family. Told me it was my duty to see to it that you didn't get away, just in case someone else fell in the ocean. He looked around at the blank walls. Creepy not to have any news at all, he said. There's a TV in the garage, she said, or maybe the attic. You could find it and plug it in and find out that no one else knows what's going on if you feel like it. Or I could escort you to the bathtub and we could scrub each other clean and then I could give you a massage, he said. Yes, or you could do that. Where did you say the television was, he said. You are going to be in so much trouble. She twined her fingers in his hair and pulled him up to kiss her. 2. Progress Pilgrims. It took 3 days for even the thinnest crawls to return to the walls. In the meantime, people dug out old one-to-many devices like radios and televisions and set them up on their lawns so that they could keep track of the aftermath of the downtime. He slept over those 3 nights because no one was going anywhere anyway, and they had a running argument over how many dates this counted as, but truth be told, they had a wonderful time making omelets for one another, washing each other's backs in the shower, stealing moments of sex at the living room at 2 in the afternoon without worrying about being interrupted by a chime, ringer, bell, or vibe. When they weren't enjoying each other, they took coolers of fizzy drinks onto the lawn and watched the neighbor's TV set and saw the pundits describing the downtime. The news shows were having a drunken ball with this one. As the only game in town, they were free to bring a level of craft to their newsmongering that hadn't been seen since Trish's parents' day, when news networks turned catastrophes into light operas complete with soundtracks, brand identities, logo marks, and intermissions where buffoons worked the audience for laughs. Oh, she's your favorite, isn't she? Trish asked, goosing Rayner's bicep and taking a sip of his peach gingerade. The pundit had been in heavy rotation since the TV went back on the air. She was a Norwegian academic mathematician who wrote books of popular philosophy. She was a collection of trademark affectations, a jacket with built-up shoulders, a monocle, a string tie, nipple tassels, and tattooed cross-hatching on her face that made her look like a woodcut of a Victorian counting house clerk. Rayner loathed her. She'd been on the committee to which he'd defended his philosophy of networks thesis, and she'd busted his balls so hard that they still ached a decade later when he saw her on the tube. The pundit explained the packet switching, using trains versus automobiles as a metaphor.
In a circuit universe, every communications gets its own dedicated line, like a train on a track. When I want to talk to you, we build a circuit, a train track, between our devices. No one else can use those tracks, even if we're not talking. But packet switching is like a freeway. We break the information into packets, and we give every packet its own little car, and it finds its own way to the other end. If one car doesn't arrive, we make a copy of its information and send it again. The cars have brakes and steering wheels, and so they can all share the same road without too much trouble.
Rayner grit his teeth and hissed at the set. She's faking the accent, he said. She thinks that Americans believe that anyone with a European accent is smarter than we are. She can pronounce V and W perfectly well when she wants to. She speaks better English than I do. Besides, she stole that line from me, he said. From my thesis, he said, his face scrunching up again. Shh, shh, Trish said, laughing at him. He wasn't really angry, she knew. Just a little stir crazy. He was a networking guy. He should have been out there trying to make the network go again, but he was on sabbatical, and no one at UCLA wanted to hear from him just then. And then the pundit was off on to ants. Networks modeled on ant colonies that use virtual pheromones to explore all possible routes in real time and emerge a solution to the problem of getting everything everywhere in shortest time. Rayner kept barking at the TV, and Trish knew he was doing it to entertain her as much as for any reason, so she laughed more and egged him on. The TV cut back to the news dude, a very cuddly Ewok who'd made his name hosting a Wheel of Fortune, jumping up and down and squeaking excitedly and adorably whenever a contestant won the grand prize, his fur plugs quivering. He cupped his paws to his cheeks and grinned.
But ants aren't perfect, are they?
The Ewok said.
He's feeding her, Raynor said. She's going to go off on her stupid walking in circles bit.
The thing about using virtual ants to map out the world and make routing recommendations is that we can't really tell the difference between a good solution and a bad one without trying it. Sometimes ants end up walking in circles, reinforcing their scent until they starve to death. We might find out that our cars tell us the best way from San Francisco to San Jose is via a 1,500-mile detour to Las Vegas. It may be true. If all the traffic everywhere else is bad enough, that might be the fastest way. But it may just be the ants going in circles.
God, talk about taking a metaphor too far, he said.
Trish thought that Raynor was perfectly happy to think about the ants as ants, except when someone raised a point like this, but she didn't see any reason to raise that point just then. The Ewok turned to the camera.
One scientist says we should expect more downtimes to come. When we come back from this break, we'll talk to a University of Waterloo researcher who claims this is just the first of many more downtimes to come.
The screen cut over to a beautiful operatic advertisement for some Brazilian brand of Coca-Cola, wittily written, brilliantly shot, with an original score by a woman who'd won 3 Grammys at the Independent Music Awards in Kamchatka the year before. They watched it with mild attention, and Trish absently fished another bottle out of the cooler and chewed the lid off with her side molars. She looked at Raynor. He was gripping the armrests of his inflatable chair tightly, dimpling the hard plastic. She held the bottle to his lips, and he took it. Then she rubbed at his shoulders while he took a swallow.
"Let's go back inside and play," she said. "They won't have anything new to tell us for days."
The Krawls were alive the next morning, exuberantly tracking across the walls and over the mirror and down the stairs. They picked out the important ones and trailed them to convenient spots with a fingertip and devoured them, reading interesting bits aloud to one another. Soon the Krawls had been tamed and only a few personal messages remained. Trish dragged hers over to the tabletop next to her cereal bowl and opened them up while she ate. Outside, she could hear the whisper of cars speeding down the road, and she supposed with a mingling of regret and relief that she should probably go into her office. She opened her personal mail. It had been 3 days since she'd read it, but for all that, a surprisingly small amount had accumulated. Of course, everyone else had been without connectivity, too. This was mostly stuff from the East Coast and Europe, people who had been awake for a couple hours. She read, filed and forwarded, tapping out the occasional one-word answer to simple questions or bouncing back messages with a form letter. Then she came to the note from the Coast Guard medic. He didn't mince words. It was in the first sentence. The surfer dude she'd rescued had had a second cardiac arrest on the boat. They'd tried what they could, but he hadn't recovered. He was a freak statistic of the downtime, another person who'd lost his life when the ants spazzed out. They'd recovered his board and found its black box. The accelerometer and GPS recorded the spill he'd taken after the loss of climate and wave condition data from the other surfers strung out on the coast. He'd stayed up for about 10 seconds before going under. She stared numbly at the note, the spoon halfway to her mouth, and then she dropped the spoon into the bowl, not noticing. She got up from the table and went into the kitchen. Raynor was there, in a change of clothes they had bought from a mom-and-pop Gap at the mall on the corner that had been taking IOUs from anyone who could show a driver's license with a local address. She grabbed his wrist, making him slosh Starbucks down his front. She took the cup out of his hand and set it down on the counter, then put her arms around his chest and hugged him. He didn't protest or ask any questions. He just put his arms around her and hugged back. Eventually she cried. Then she told him what she was crying about. She let him tell her that she was a hero, that she'd saved Jory's life and almost saved the surfer's life, and she let him tell her that it wasn't her fault for sloshing into the ocean to rinse off the barf, and she let him tell her that he loved her, and she cried until she thought she was cried out, and then she started again. He took her upstairs, and he lay her down on the bed. He undressed her, and she let him. He put her in fluffy jammies, and she let him. He wiped away her makeup and her hot tears with a cool face cloth, and she let him. He took her hand and ran his fingers over her fingernails, squeezing each one a little the way she liked, and she let him. "You're going to have a nice lie down for a couple hours, and I'm going to be right beside you, I'll call the department secretary and tell him you're taking a personal day and will be in tomorrow. Then we're going to go see Jory and his family, so that you can see the boy whose life you saved. And then we are going to go for a walk in the hills, and then I'm going to put you to bed. When you get up in the morning, you can make an appointment to see a grief counselor or not. Today I'm in charge, all right? Her heart swelled with love, and she felt a tear slip down her cheek. Rainer, she said, you're a wonder. You inspire me, darling, he said, and kissed her eyelids shut. Their 35th date was their last. End of part one. When you're taking a break in the middle of a story that good, you want to fill it with something on the order of Tolstoy. And that's precisely what I have for you now. The no-shit great-great-granddaughter of Leo the Scribbler, and one of the great jazz singers of the current era, Victoria Tolstoy.
Searching for someone you can tear down, 'cause you can't stand a sparkling friend. You've been looking for keys to my most secret room, but I tell you they never been found. 'Cause no one has looked, and neither will you, as long as there's party around. I will walk on these eyes, you can make me fall. It's not important for me to stay cool. I will walk on these high heels 'cause I like the view. I will hold my head close to the stars. Cause a friend is a friend and someone you can trust. You don't need to lock all your doors. 'Cause a friend can step in and step out for a while, but she never will take what is yours. I will walk on these high heels, you can make me fall. It's not important for me to stay cool. I will walk on these high heels 'cause I like the view. I will hold my head close to the stars. inside, you weigh yourself down. You are searching for someone you can't take down, 'cause you can't stand a sparkling friend. You've been looking for keys to my most secret room, but I tell you they never been found, 'cause no one has looked and neither will you, as long as there's party around. I will walk on these eyes, you can't make me fall, it's not important for me to stay cool. I will walk on these high heels 'cause I like the view. I will hold my head close to the stars. I will walk on these high heels. You can't make me fall. Oh, walk on these high heels. I will hold my head close to the stars.
Two of Ms. Tolstoy's better CDs are titled My Russian Soul and My Swedish Heart, and that live track you just heard certainly delivers both. She was then in Stockholm, being accompanied by three other Swedes, Esbjörn Svensson on piano, bassman Dan Berglund, and drummer Magnus Östrom, known collectively as the Esbjörn Svensson Trio. Esbjörn, one of the greatest jazz pianists of all time, died just last year at age 44 in a scuba accident near Stockholm. As it happens, his last public performance was in Moscow at Tchaikovsky Hall on my wife's birthday. He produced one of Victoria Tolstoy's early CDs. When you're done checking out her catalog, do be sure and hunt down the music of EST, the Esbjörn Svensson Trio. Whoops! Okay, friends, fate seems to have taken a hand. In fact, an arm and a leg. I apologize. I did fully intend to bring you the entire text of Cory Doctorow's novella Human Readable in this podcast, as I promised at its beginning, but I just looked up and noticed that I've already hit my nominal one-hour limit, and the second half of the story runs more than an hour all by itself. In other words, as Lennon and McCartney so eloquently put it, I'm a big teaser! I took you halfway there now. To find out how everything comes out, in other words, I'm afraid you're going to have to come back for Spider on the Web number 75. To blunt the pain, I will leave you with an extra track apiece by each of this episode's musical guests, Watermelon Slim and the Workers from No Paid Holidays, Victoria Tolstoy, and the Esbjörn Svensson Trio. This podcast may occasionally be late or incomplete, but at least you do always get more than 38 grams in every lid. And I promise I will at least try and bring you the next installment early for a change. Keep visiting SpiderRobinson.com to see if I manage to pull it off. In closing, I want to express my ongoing extreme gratitude to everyone who has contributed so overwhelmingly generously to Jeannie's battle with chemotherapy, by donation or by taking part in the Dream for Jeannie auctions, which Jan Schroeder continues to run on eBay on Jeannie's behalf, or simply by sending your encouraging messages of support via either Facebook or email to spiderweb@shaw.ca. Your support has made an incredible difference for both Jeannie and me, and we won't forget it. If any of this is new to you, check out Jeannie's blog at stardancemovie.com. The most recent entries will bring you up to speed and give you a peek at our granddaughter, Marissa. Now, here's Watermelon Slim with a couple of extremely important questions for us all.
We are in this lovely hotel, looking down on a war zone. We're in this lovely hotel, looking down on a war zone. We saw it all breaking down, soldiers and the people they was firing on. Now I wonder what the U.S. press thinks of this. I wonder what the American press will do with this. I wonder if they're even listening, or if they're just doing customary business.
Thank you. there for me to bear and for you to forget. Your road is set. I will have you know you reap what you sow. You sleep, you will fall just as I. Foolishly trusting a lie. Broken and spun on the floor. Finding that love is no more.
Swan Lake. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Man, you really gotta wonder what great-great-grandpa Leo would have thought of that one, huh? And now to take us home, here's the Esbjörnsvenson Trio with The Gold-Hearted Miner.